From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. As federal agencies deploy more resources and manpower on the streets of Baltimore, we talk to two leaders of the federal crime fight here, the U.S. Attorney, Rod Rosenstein, and the agent in charge of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Field Office, Bill McMullen. Then, men far outnumber women in Shakespeare's plays, but not in the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production of Henry IV, Part 1. Its cast is all female. Our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, tells us how these warring women fare on Shakespeare's battlefield. And 4 years ago today, Johns Hopkins honor student Nathan Krasnopoler died after months in a coma. He'd been struck on his bicycle by an 83-year-old motorist. Today, his mother teaches a safety class to older drivers. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're starting the second week of a two-month partnership between Baltimore police and federal crime-fighting agencies. Elected and law enforcement officials announced with great fanfare a week ago, that 10 federal agents would be embedded with the Baltimore police homicide detectives and work to bring justice to at least some of those behind the 50 unsolved murder cases since the riot in April. Baltimore's interim police commissioner, Kevin Davis.
These federal agencies are sending us special agents, and they're going to be embedded with the BPD, with our homicide detectives, and they're going to be on the streets of Baltimore.
Agents from the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service, and the U.S. Secret Service will work with Baltimore City Police on cases where police have identified suspects but need more resources to file charges. With me to talk about the federal role in addressing the surge in violence in Baltimore is United States Attorney Rod J. Rosenstein, the top federal prosecutor in Maryland. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also with us is William McMullen, special agent in charge of the Baltimore Field Division of the ATF, which is detailing two more agents to this new partnership. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks.
Special Agent McMullen, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, as I understand it, already has a dozen agents in what's called the war room that Interim Commissioner Kevin Davis set up last month. What's the difference? What is the work of the war room, and how is it different from this new partnership?
The War Room is an initiative that Interim Commissioner Davis set up for the city to identify violent repeat offenders. They're really, from what we've seen, there's a small amount of people in the city that are responsible for most of the crime in the city. So this War Room is to identify those individuals and work together to figure out the best way that the agencies can collaborate to target those individuals. So For ATF, we were able to bring in 13 agents from outside of Baltimore City to work directly on that initiative. These agents are experienced agents. They're experienced in working street-level enforcement, undercover operations, surveillance, working with informants. It's more street-level enforcement. This is in addition to the proactive cases that we normally work and have worked historically in Baltimore City over the years. But for these agents, they're going to be side-by-side with Baltimore City detectives working on the street, identifying and targeting those violent repeat offenders that are associated with the war room.
I'm sorry. So you were describing just then the war room activity.
Yes.
And when you said for these agents, you're talking about the agents in the war room or this new set of agents from multiple?
We brought in agents outside of Baltimore for both initiatives at the same time. The War Room Initiative and the Homicide Unit Initiative. And we've been able to assign agents to the War Room Initiative, 13 agents from outside Baltimore City, and 2 agents to the Homicide Unit. So both initiatives, we've been able to bring in additional manpower to assist and work with the city on.
So Mayor Rawlings Blake called this new BFED task force, quote, the next step of an all-hands-on-deck movement addressing violence in our community. Rod Rosenstein, I'm still not sure that I'm getting why this is the next step up. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an additional or supplemental step. Pardon me. We've been working proactively with the Baltimore Police Department for a very long time, bringing the resources we have in the federal government to bear to work with local police, primarily to do what we call proactive cases. Proactive in the sense that typically federal agents are not responding to 911 calls. They're not responding in the scene of last night's homicide. What they're trying to do is analyze crime patterns and determine where problems are likely to arise in the future. So it's really a crime prevention model. What the BFED task force, where it differs, where the homicide group differs, is that they're doing reactive investigations where you actually have federal agents going out with local police to investigate homicides. That's something we haven't done before.
Never in Baltimore?
Well, not on the spur of the moment. Typically, what we would do is we'd work with the police department. They would determine, for example, in a particular area of the city, they've had a spike in homicides, and they'd ask our federal agents to come in and develop conspiracy cases. In other words, figure out what gangs are behind this violence and try to develop a federal investigation, often involving surveillance, undercover operatives, the use of informants, to try to bring a significant conspiracy case where we can remove a gang that's causing a problem in the community. Those cases, though, are long-term investigations. They'll typically take 3, 4, 5, 6 months or more to develop the evidence that you need in order to charge that gang, that group, with committing crimes and put them out of business. The reactive crime, that is responding to the homicide, figuring out who did the shooting last night, now that's something that typically federal agents have not been involved in, but our federal partners, and particularly ATF, have stepped up here and brought in additional resources. So as a supplement to the proactive work that we're doing, we're actually working alongside those homicide detectives, responding to scenes, conducting interviews, and trying to solve those murders.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, talking about the federal response to the surge in violence in Baltimore with the top federal prosecutor in Maryland, U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein, and the special agent in charge of the Baltimore field office of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, Bill McMullen. U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski said the BFED partnership gives Baltimore police access to resources. This is essentially, I think, what you're describing, resources to analyze evidence. She's the example of advanced ballistics capabilities of the ATF, which she said would mean, quote, we can get the bullets. We know what guns they came from. We can see, are they from a single killer? Are they from a gang? Are they from a syndicate? They bring those resources, close quote. Special Agent McMullen, wasn't that kind of cooperation already going on?
Yes, it was, but it's more. It's just right now. There's a more of an effort between all the agencies to work together, and I think it's just more of an increased effort and more collaboration with everyone being under one roof instead of, we always had strong partnerships in the city with all the different agencies, but it's gotten stronger recently with the collaboration that we've had. U.S. Attorney Rosenstein has done a good job bringing us all together to make sure we're regularly meeting. All the federal agencies, special agents in charge, are at the table discussing investigations and working together. And also Interim Commissioner Davis has done the same thing with bringing all the federal partners together. We have a system that I think the senator is talking about is NIBIN. It's the National Integrated Ballistic Identification Network. It's a comprehensive database that ATF has with Baltimore City, where shell casings from different shootings across the city are put into this system. And the key to this is it matches shootings in different locations. So an example is if a shooting occurred over the weekend and there were no leads on it, the shell casings from that scene are put into the system. And if a shooting occurred last night where somebody might have just shot a stop sign and it was no shooting, those shell casings are put into the system. And the system matches those shootings. And maybe there's no leads on a homicide, but there's leads on the person who shot the stop sign because everyone saw that person. So that gives us a way to be able to match shootings and put those shell casings into the system and follow up on leads.
If you see the same shell casings, you know that's the same gun.
Unique characteristics from the barrel of the gun that will show up on the shell casing, and they will match, showing that the shell casings came from the same weapon.
And that's more likely to be used when you've got your agents there on scene, either in the war room or on the street doing the crime scene investigation.
Yes, it just makes us there right in the beginning of the shooting. So we're there to conduct interviews with the city detectives. We're there for the timeliness of the shell casings. When those shell casings are put in, the key is that we are able to act on those leads quickly instead of time going by where the leads are drying up. So it really helps us where we're out there actively on the shooting scenes.
U.S. Attorney Rosenstein, penalties in the federal criminal justice system are much tougher than in the state system. No probation, no parole, less time off for good behavior. I've always been told that facing that, defenders in federal cases have more incentive to cooperate, to give information to investigators. And so I assumed when I first heard about this partnership that one of the goals was to make federal cases out of many of the crimes that we have seen in Baltimore since the riot.
Well, that's
true or false?
That's true. That's one of the many things that we do is we bring the federal resources to bear, which include not just investigative resources, but prosecutorial resources. That is, as you mentioned, the longer sentences. In some cases, where appropriate, mandatory penalties, where a defendant's only opportunity to get out from under that mandatory penalty would be to cooperate and provide information about other criminals. And so that's been one of the keys in our federal conspiracy cases, to gain that cooperation by using the leverage of those tough federal penalties. And we're doing that in appropriate cases. But what we're doing differently now, what Bill McMullen is talking about, is that we're assisting the police department in reacting to this spate of homicides. And I think if you just look at the numbers and have a sense of what the police department is dealing with, last year at this time, these are numbers as of this morning, they had 134 murders year-to-date in Baltimore City. They're up 72 murders over this time last year, about 57%. And non-fatal shootings, which, of course, you know, often it's purely luck that a non-fatal shooting is not a homicide as well. There are 172 more non-fatal shootings than there were at this time last year. So if you add those two together, murders and non-fatal shootings, you've got 244 more incidents to be investigated, which has really been taxing the resources of the police department and on top of all the other work that they do. And so these federal agents are helping. I think one of the important things that they're doing, in addition to bringing expertise, is just the raw manpower to supplement the resources of the police department.
We're going to continue this conversation. We have to break here for news. And when we get back, I'd like to ask you, among other things, how the Black Lives Matter movement is affecting the fight against crime. That's U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein and Bill McMullen, special agent in charge of the Baltimore field office of the ATF. We'll be back in a few minutes. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast, joined in the studio by the Chief Federal Prosecutor in Maryland, U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein, and by the Special Agent in charge of the Baltimore Field Office of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF. We've been talking about the partnership between federal agencies and Baltimore police and trying to get the surge in violence of the past 3 months under control. Special Agent McMullen, the ATF works mostly gun cases, firearms? Is that the part? Is that what brings you?
Our main focus is firearms investigations, violent crime.
Violent
crime, firearms-related violent crime is our main focus.
But yes. Arsons also fall under ATF.
Yes.
Tell me about what you've been doing or what you were doing about arsons in Baltimore during the riot.
Well, really, the first night of that the riots really erupted on the 27th, I think, of April, I went over to the Baltimore Police Department headquarters, met with the commissioner and his command staff, talked to them about what they needed right away. And the main initial need that they needed from ATF that we could bring to the table was our national response team. The national response team is made up of members from across the country, ATF agents who were specialized in working fire scenes. They're certified fire investigators. So they have to go through intensive training. And then after they finalize the training, they're certified fire investigators. They come from different parts of the country. I was able to bring in 50 agents from across the country. From across the country. Really, that's first night, I was able to get authorization, and the next day they were en route to Baltimore. With them, they work very systematically. They work a unified effort with, they'll team up with the Baltimore City Police Department, the Fire Department, and the Fire Marshal's Office. They brought, also the U.S. Attorney's Office was very involved in our whole team effort. When we first met, we came up with our game plan, and we went out and, for us, ATF, we had 7 active fire scenes that we were able to put agents on simultaneously and work at the same time. We also had 3 incendiary devices that were lit in the street that we added to our investigations. But with the national response team, they'll bring in experts that are fire protection engineers, forensic chemists, electrical engineers. We'll sift through every piece of evidence at those scenes to determine the cause and origin of the fires and also try to find out who's responsible for them. So
on July 2nd, U.S. Attorney Rosenstein, your office announced that Raymond Carter had been charged with arson. What made that a federal case?
Well, the fact that it was an arson of a commercial establishment is one of the bases for federal jurisdiction. There are various ways we gain federal jurisdiction over arsons. That's typically the one that we use. And so in that case, the use of an incendiary device or the commission of arson in a commercial establishment would be sufficient to give us federal jurisdiction. And the reason we think it's important, Sheila, is because we need to make clear that there's a deterrent. The people are out there during a riot. They feel like they have anonymity. They feel like they have maybe some degree of protection against prosecution. But these cases, we hope, will send a message that we can track you down, that there are cameras out there, that there are trained ATF investigators working with fire marshals who can gather this evidence. And so we're going to continue working these cases, and I anticipate there will be more brought in the future. And so my hope is that we'll send a deterrent message and people will think twice before engaging in this kind of violence again.
As I understand it, you extracted still photos from surveillance video and put those still photos on reward posters. And then what happened?
Yes, that was critical, actually. With all the evidence that we were able to gather from the scenes, the interviews that we conducted with witnesses of those fire scenes, when we're able to put all that together, our ATF lab is located in Amondale, Maryland. So we're able to bring that evidence to the lab. But then when you add the video surveillance inside the stores and outside the stores, the CCTV video cameras on the street, and then just video that people have on the street and the photographers that were there, when we combined all that, we were able to, that was critical in us identifying who was responsible for the fires. And then having to put those out on the reward posters and getting tips from the citizens, putting all that together was critical for us to be able to identify who was responsible.
So tips from citizens were what led you to Carter?
That was part of what led us to him, in addition to, like I said, all the other evidence. But it was very important, the tips that we got from the public.
Interim Police Commissioner Kevin Davis said that the agents on loan to the city will be on the street, the federal agents. We've heard from the police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, that Baltimore homicide detectives this spring have sometimes had difficulty conducting investigations on the street because of protesters, people recording them, just sort of general hubbub. What have your agents experienced?
I think the agents that we brought in, they're all experienced agents. They've dealt with violence in the cities that they work in, and they're used to that. I mean, that's part of the job. But we haven't had any violent altercations on the street. It's just normal course of business, really. There hasn't been anything significant that our agents have run into.
U.S. Attorney Rosenstein, let me ask you, overall, what impact does the Black Lives Matter movement have on crime fighting?
Well, from a law enforcement perspective, Sheila, obviously we investigate every murder equally. The Black Lives Matter movement really isn't just about murder, though. It's about allegations of police abuse. And the federal government has a special responsibility and a special role to investigate allegations of police abuse. So the U.S. Attorney's Office works very closely with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department in Washington and with the FBI to investigate any incidents in which there are allegations that police are involved improperly in either abusing or killing a suspect. And if there's a determination that there is predication for an investigation, we will then commit the resources to conduct that investigation, as, for example, we've done in the Freddie Gray matter.
Does the U.S. Attorney's Office have any role in the Justice Department's review of policing in Baltimore, the review of the police department that's underway?
Yes, we do. With regard to the Civil Rights Division's investigation, what they refer to as a pattern and practice investigation,
right.
The U.S. Attorney's Office supports that. The resources are primarily from the Civil Rights Division, but we have attorneys who provide assistance when needed.
That's U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein here on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Special Agent in Charge Bill McMullen. He heads the ATF field office here in Baltimore. We're talking about the federal response to Baltimore's surge in crime. U.S. Attorney Rosenstein, other cities are seeing a big uptick in, I shouldn't say uptick. That implies that I know it's going to end, and we haven't seen that yet.
Mm-hmm.
In Baltimore, certainly, August continues with high 9 homicides so far this month. But other cities are seeing an increase in homicides, too.
Mm-hmm.
Chiefs of police from several cities met in Washington last week to share ideas about it. In what ways is Baltimore similar to these other cities?
Mm-hmm.
In what ways is Baltimore different?
Well, you know, my responsibility is Maryland, and particularly Baltimore is where I spend most of my time and attention, so I have no expertise in the other cities. I think there are some commonalities in the sense that, in many communities, you could remove police entirely and there wouldn't be any murders. A place like Baltimore, unfortunately, there are underlying causes that create these rivalries, the murders. Most of them are drug-related in Baltimore, and so you have violent drug organizations that are shooting each other, and sometimes they're engaging in retaliatory violence. I think the commonality with other jurisdictions, and not to comment on what the particular issues might be in Milwaukee or Chicago, for example, but the commonality is the need for law enforcement to gain the respect and cooperation of citizens. Because to solve these crimes, we need cooperation. We need cooperation of other criminals in many cases, but also of citizens on the street, people who call in tips like we've had, for example, in these arson cases. And we need people to support rather than impede investigations. When there's a murder, for example, and police are responding, as Agent McMullen mentioned, we can conduct those investigations anyway, but if we have to devote additional resources to holding back a crowd, for example, those are people who could be doing something constructive in terms of investigating. And so I think the key to solving the problem, not just here but nationally, is probably regaining trust in police so that citizens, and when they hear sirens and they see police responding, their reaction will be that they want to support the police and help them achieve the goal of stopping crime. And they'll see the police as partners in protecting the community and not as invaders who are there to harm them.
Special Agent McMullen, that seems like a special challenge. As I understand it, if I've been following your comments correctly, all the agents that came to the war room are detailed from other cities, and you're adding an additional 2 agents to this latest BFED partnership. They're from
other
someplace
areas,
else.
Yeah.
I think the DEA is adding 2 marshals, or there's 2 U.S. marshals, there's 1 Secret Service and 1 FBI agent involved in this latest partnership. How can out-of-towners develop that kind of trust quickly to the extent that they're on the street with citizens?
Well, for us, we're teaming up. We're in the same car with Baltimore City detectives. So they're not driving on their own and trying to find out what's happening. They're embedded literally with the Baltimore City detectives. So they are side by side with them. And I don't think people on the street will determine, you know, this is a Baltimore ATF agent or an ATF agent from New York or Philadelphia or Charlotte that's coming in for, you know, several months to assist. For us, it doesn't change what we do. We're still just trying to make sure that whatever we can do, whatever ATF can bring to the table, resources and manpower to assist Baltimore City, that's what we're going to do. So I really don't think it matters if they're from here or if they're from another area. they are daily discussing everything going on the street with our Baltimore City groups that are still actively working every day. So they're coordinating with the groups to make sure whatever cases we actively have going on, if they're running in an area where we have an active case already, they're coordinating those efforts with our groups and all the federal agencies. So in my opinion, I think it's just a matter of putting ATF agents on the street. It doesn't matter if they're from here or not.
Rod Rosenstein, how common is it for federal agents to embed in a local police department?
The embedding is actually relatively uncommon. Bill, I'm not sure this is the first time we've done it, but I think it's the most significant effort ever made in terms of the volume, the number of agents who are actually doing this reactive work, embedding, going out on calls with the local police department.
What happens after 60 days?
Well, in federal law enforcement, we're dealing with a fixed number of agents, so to some extent it's a zero-sum game. We make our case to our bosses in Washington about why we think we need additional resources in Baltimore and what we think they can do, and they need to make a decision about whether they have resources to spare and what impact it might have in other jurisdictions. ATF, fortunately, has had this program in place for many years now where they will surge resources to areas that are experiencing spikes in violence. And so ATF has the model to do that, but it is a short-term model. There's no guarantee that these folks will be here beyond 60 days. We'll have to wait and see how effective they are, and then make our case for whether or not they ought to be continued.
We have just a minute left, and there's another topic I wanted to ask you about, and that is the closing of the Men's Detention Center in Baltimore. When Governor Hogan announced it, he talked at length about the corruption, which was highlighted mm-hmm. in federal indictments that you brought. So what was your reaction, first mm-hmm. of all, to the closing of the Men's Detention Center, and what do you think happens now?
I think it's a positive development. One of the things we discovered in the course of the investigation was that the structure, the age of the facility, and the way it was designed really facilitated corruption. Modern facilities are designed to try to minimize the blank spaces where management, for example, is unable to see what's happening. They're designed with more open areas, and they're prepared electronically so that surveillance can be conducted throughout the facility. So I think a modern facility will significantly improve on the problems that they had in Baltimore City. It doesn't eliminate the challenge of jail corruption. Whenever you have prisoners, criminals who are incarcerated for extended periods of time, there's a possibility of corruption. And so I think that's something the Department of Public Safety is attuned to, and they're trying to make internal changes as well, so that whatever the structure, the facility is like, they've got the people in place and the policies that will try to minimize corruption.
We have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Special Agent in Charge Bill McMullen of the ATF Field Office in Baltimore and U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, a message for older drivers. Stay with us on 88.1.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wipr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
I'm Sheila Cass. This is Maryland Morning. For decades, men have dominated the stage when it comes to Shakespeare's plays. But the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory has turned that old notion on its head with an all-female production of Henry IV, Part 1. Jaywin Russick brings us her review.
It certainly sounds strange, an all-female production of Henry IV, Part 1. A Shakespeare history play in which almost all of the characters are men. But there's precedent, a lot of it. There are all-female Shakespeare companies from New York to Los Angeles to London. Sarah Bernhardt played Hamlet in 1899. So did Eva Le Gallienne in the 1930s. More recently, Helen Mirren starred as Prospero in the 2010 film of The Tempest. And Center Stage will produce an all-female As You Like It in January. Casting all women is just the flip side of what went on in Shakespeare's day, when all roles, by law, were played by men. In a program note for the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's current production of Henry IV, Part 1, director Tom DeLise offers another justification. Historically, female political leaders are nothing new. I'd add that this particularly resonates now, when a woman is the Democratic frontrunner for the United States presidency. Director DeLeese changes the gender of his cast, but not Shakespeare's characters. The pronouns are unaltered, and the male characters portrayed as men in trousers or tights. But while the body language is generally masculine, the voices remain feminine. Here's Valerie Dowdle as Henry IV, chastising his wayward son, Prince Hal, played by Anne Turiano.
Tell me, else, could such inordinate and low desires accompany the greatness of thy blood?
I shall hereafter, my thrice gracious lord, be more myself.
Henry IV, Part 1, is the coming-of-age story of Prince Hal, who later becomes King Henry V. Hal's path to adulthood is guided by two father figures. Hal's birth father, stern Henry IV, represents leadership. Hal's surrogate father, portly, profligate Sir John Falstaff, represents hedonism. Falstaff is larger than life in every sense. Shakespeare scholar Harold Bloom insists Falstaff is matched in magnitude only by Hamlet. So a winning portrayal of Falstaff, by a man or woman, is crucial. Kay Megan Washington delivers that winning portrayal. She's the familiar, belly-scratching, tall tale-telling, wine-swilling Falstaff. But her warm, almost musical speech imbues every word with the love and friendship Falstaff feels for Prince Hal.
Sirrah, do I owe you £1,000?
£1,000, Hal! 1,000,000! Thy love is worth 1,000,000. Thou owest me thy love.
Meanwhile, Anne Turiano's nuanced depiction of Hal shows him preparing to leave the carousing friends of his youth and accept the duties, many on the battlefield, of the crown. The battlefield scenes, however, tend to be awkward, and the supporting performances uneven. Static blocking is another problem. These difficulties, however, have nothing to do with cross-gender casting. Occasionally, you even forget you're watching women in men's roles. If anything, the all-female casting brings new pertinence to a 400-year-old history play. That pertinence concerns more than politics. The production comes at a time when women are receiving more attention in theater. Baltimore's Parody Fest is part of a national initiative focused on female playwrights. And another local company, Glass Mind Theater, has just opened an original female-driven adaptation of Aeschylus's Oresteia. Titled The Pretties, the adaptation is by Anne Turiano, yes, the same person playing Prince Hal for the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory. So the time seems right for director Tom DeLeese's take on Henry IV, Part 1. There are some theories, in fact, that Shakespeare's plays were written by a woman. I wouldn't go that far, but it is refreshing to see women on the throne instead of just serving as the power behind it. Run away, yeah, with me.
That's theater critic Jaywin Russick bringing us her review as she does every Monday. Henry IV, Part 1, presented by the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory, continues in the meadow at Johns Hopkins University's Evergreen Museum and Library until Sunday, and then will run at the St. Mary's Community Center in Hamden weekend after next. I'm Sheila Cast.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. You may remember the tragic headlines of 4 years ago. The brilliant Johns Hopkins sophomore, a computer major who cared about health and sustainable agriculture, bicycling in a bike lane on West University Parkway when a car turned right in front of him. The bicyclist, Nathan Krasnopoler, was pinned under the car, but the 83-year-old motorist, apparently disoriented, did not turn the car off or call for help. She sat on a nearby wall until a passerby intervened. The collision threw Nathan Krasnopoler, age 20, into a coma with severe brain damage. He died 5 months later, 4 years ago today. To bring some good from the tragedy, his mother, Susan Cohen, an attorney, has immersed herself in the work of raising the safety of other older drivers. This morning, on the anniversary of her son's death, she'll be teaching a class in older driver safety at a community center here in Baltimore. And I spoke with Susan Cohen on Friday from her home in suburban Kansas City. Thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This must be a tough time. Tell us about the organization you founded, Americans for Older Driver Safety. What does it do?
I'm trying to fill in some of the gaps that exist in terms of educating people about safe driving as they age. Apparently, there's been a lot of research going on in the past 20 years with regard to this subject, but unfortunately, there's just not a lot of public awareness. And my organization is aimed at education and developing educational materials that can be made available to the public. And I'm also advocating that the states do more to raise awareness and to educate the public. And largely, that's what I do.
How big a problem is safety among older drivers? I mean, some of the statistics indicate older drivers aren't as big a problem as teenage drivers.
Oh, that's true. But the older driver population is growing enormously and at a much faster pace than the teenage population. So you're right, there are a lot of crashes with those very inexperienced younger drivers who take way too many risks. But unfortunately, the population of older drivers is increasing at a very rapid rate. The oldest of the baby boomers are going to be turning age 70 in 2016. That's the oldest of them. And for the next 20 years, at least, there's going to be a huge increase of older drivers. And they are overall pretty safe drivers. They don't drink and drive for the most part, and they do many things to reduce risk. But unfortunately, many of them are unaware of the medical conditions that might affect their ability to drive safely, and they continue to drive with those conditions, and many times killing themselves, their passengers, and unfortunately also others.
So I understand that you have some policy recommendations. I guess in particular, one of the things you focus on is how frequently older drivers are tested for their driving skills.
No, it's not the testing. It's more the renewing in person in the states. The research shows that if a state has a driver renew in person, that has a positive effect on identifying drivers that are medically impaired. Sometimes it's because the staff at the licensing facility sees that there's a problem, and sometimes it's because the driver themselves is not able to actually get that renewal done because of these medical problems. But it really, the research is continuing right now. And in fact, there's a pilot program going on in Iowa in which there will be a quick cognitive screen of everybody renewing. And that cognitive screen would help identify who needs a further look. Nobody would be rejected from licensure on the basis of the screen, but it would identify what group needs to have further review in order to determine their ability to drive safely. That is what I'm hoping will be in the future in every state.
That's Attorney Susan Cohen here on Maryland Morning WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She's the mother of Nathan Krasnopoler, who died 4 years ago today after being struck on his bicycle by a driver in her 80s. Susan and her family founded Americans for Older Driver Safety. So what is the situation in Maryland about how often somebody needs to show up to renew?
Well, unfortunately, Maryland is one of the worst in the nation. Maryland used to have a 5-year renewal cycle, and every other renewal was in person. So they extended that to 8 years, and actually it's being phased in right now. So in, I guess, a year or more, it'll be everybody getting renewed at 8 years. But every other time is in person. So there could be 16 years between trips to the Motor Vehicle Administration for a renewal license. And unfortunately, that's pretty much the bottom of the heap in the U.S.
I want to talk just briefly about the
older drivers in their families? I mean, presumably most older drivers think that they are competent when they get behind the wheel. We don't want things to get to the point where there's tragic evidence that they're not competent. What can families do?
Well, families need to encourage the older driver to drive with them. So the younger family member is the passenger and the older driver is the driver, and they need to observe what's going on. And if there are questionable behaviors behind the wheel and bad moves or missed signs or signals, then they need to be checked out. Most doctors, primary care doctors, are able to do cognitive screens or refer for a brief cognitive screen. You can also determine with the eye doctor whether or not peripheral vision is missing and what is the field of vision. There's a lot of things that can be determined medically, and of course drivers and their families need to talk to doctors. The most wonderful resource we have in Maryland is several programs where the branch of occupational therapy that specializes in driver rehabilitation and driver evaluation is very, there's a lot of them in Maryland, whereas some states have none. We have maybe five or six different programs going on in Maryland, and those are occupational therapists that are involved. Like, for example, Sinai Hospital has one. So does St. Agnes. But anyway, those programs are excellent for determining whether or not a driver is truly capable of driving safely and getting the equipment or perhaps the coaching they need to become a safe driver.
Susan, thank you for walking us through this. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Susan Cohen, founder of Americans for Older Driver Safety. She's in Baltimore to mark the fourth anniversary of the death of her son, Nathan Krasnopoler, in an accident with an 83-year-old motorist. Susan is speaking this morning to a group of senior men at the Edward Meyerberg Center on Falstaff Road in Baltimore. If you'd like her to speak to your group, you can reach her through the AFOD's website. We have a link to that at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1885, inventor Leo Daft started America's first commercially operated streetcar when he converted the Baltimore and Hamden line from horse-drawn cars to cars powered by electric current. We'll be chugging back here on Wednesday. Please come with us.